This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Visit FUBARradio.com for more details. FUBAR!
Oh, that's... Thank you to those gorgeous, gorgeous people. It's a lovely handover with them. Hello, it's Lucy Porter here for 2 hours of live lady chat. I've got two lovely ladies waiting outside. And we're going to talk about... China. We're going to talk about leggings. We're going to talk about sexual intercourse. I remember that. Vaguely, in the dim and distant past. And we are going to have our record of the week, which this week is now. I chose this one because I think too few people know about this woman. And I intend to put that right today. So, Amanda, will you announce the record of the week,
please? With great pleasure. I announce the record of the week is Lynn Collins, the best of...
Yes, yes, yes. And it is the best of the best. It's an amazing record. And she is an incredible woman. So she worked with the James Brown All-Stars.
Right.
She is a funk princess and not sufficiently well-known as far as I'm concerned.
Well, she's a new one on me, actually. I've got no idea who Lynn Collins is. So I'm looking forward to my education.
Well, there is a song on this record that is my theme tune that I intend to use for my brand new stand-up show. You heard it here first.
This is a scoop.
This is an absolute scoop for those of you who care. I will be using Mama Feel Good as my play-in music for my new show, because that's how I like to see myself. I'm Mama Feel Good. And if you listen to the lyrics, you will understand why. Do we have that one? Could we possibly play that as our first tune?
I could play a slightly longer one.
Oh, I do need a wee.
Yeah, this is what I'm thinking. I've queued up a 4.5...
I was too busy enjoying the show before ours to remember to go to the lavatory.
I've queued up a 4.5-minute song.
And which song is that?
Give It Up, Turn It Loose.
Oh, let's do... I'm going to give it up and turn it loose in the lavatory. Ooh, and lovely. I'll be right back with some gorgeous guests after this.
The Lucy Porter Show on FUBAR Radio.
Oh, there she was, Lynn Collins. Letting it loose. Very good. So, yeah, part of the James Brown... collective of funk superstars, and everyone knows about James Brown. Not so many people know about Lynn Collins. Let's put that right. The two wonderful women I was referring to are now in studio. Ooh. We have our friend, your friend and mine, the lovely, the wonderful, the amazing Wendy Wason.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure, never a chore. And we have a bonus talented, wonderful Scottish woman as well. It's two brilliant Scottish women, and it's Valerie Edmund.
Thank you so much for saying that. I've never had an introduction like that ever. Thank
you.
Oh,
I bet you've had some good
introductions.
Yeah,
you have.
BAFTA award-winning bloody actor.
Have you got a BAFTA?
Yeah, well, no, actually, I was nominated. I didn't win.
BAFTA nominated.
Wow.
Do you know what? In that situation, I normally just style it out and go, yeah.
Sorry, I should have gone, yeah. I was like, wow.
I know, I got told that I had won the Perrier Award for comedy in Edinburgh on a live show once, and you could see my little face sort of I was sort of there going, well, I could say something, but I prefer not to. I'll just sit there and take it. Yeah. So,
which is a better face than the one that I saw recently, where Kevin Federline, they've got online the face that Kevin Federline wore when he saw that he'd been dumped by text by Britney Spears.
They captured that very moment.
Yeah, apparently they have that.
Oh, God, that's painful, isn't it?
So, not winning the Perry Award is infinitely superior to...
Being dumped by
your wife.
Yes. I dodged a bullet there.
There you go. Sorry, look at me. Positive.
I know, little Miss Sunshine there.
No, but look at her sitting on her chair.
Yes, we had a lovely bit of physical comedy.
We weren't going to mention that.
I think the listeners would want to know.
I hate you all.
It was a very funny moment.
Women are so supportive, aren't they?
As Wendy said, she went down like Madonna. She collapsed. But we do have, in the FUBAR studio, I like to paint a little picture for our listeners at home, who probably imagine that we're all reclining on chaise longue and being fed peeled grapes by muscular young men. We are on the world's most uncomfortable stools, which are too high. It's almost like they are making a mockery of 4'11" me. But today it was Wendy who took a tumble, and we all enjoyed it, Wendy. Well,
turns
done.
Out it's not as easy to just hop on a stool as you think.
Well, it leads us on. You see, what you've done there is you've actually teed up our first discussion point. So you're doing great.
More than happy to help.
To this
Thank you, Valerie.
Because I was going to set up, we always do a list every week. Last week we did female superheroes and we asked people to tell us about their favourite female superheroes, of which there are too few. But we had a very good, do you know what, my phone's just died, so I will tell you later on who it was who got in touch to say that Velma from Scooby-Doo was their first female superhero, which is stretching the definition.
What about Wonder Woman?
Yeah, Wonder Woman, she's in Firestar.
It's so bizarre because Wonder Woman, I always thought was, because my initials are WW, I always thought that was a real shock for me that other people might like Wonder Woman.
Oh, she was yours. But dun, 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 Wendy Wayson!
Yeah, and that's kind of...
Dun, 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 Wendy like Wayson! In a satin tights, fighting for your rights, falling off the street.
Carrie Gotham. And I had an argument about it because she had her show that was called Carrie Godleman, Wonder Woman. I was like, Carrie, it makes no sense. Carrie Godleman, Wonder Woman. Wendy Wayson, Wonder Woman. She was like, Wendy, you don't own this.
Yeah, okay, you can have it.
I know. I always think of Wonder Woman as your special friend, don't worry.
I think Thelma from Scooby-Doo. I mean, that's...
Yeah. I thought it was a good... she was an intellectual superhero.
Her
power was deduction and reasoning.
You know, that was my son and my daughter were having an argument once, and I remember being blown away by the... You know when...
Falling off your stool.
Yeah, they have arguments in the back seat of the car as you're driving along, and Bella was arguing about how great Twilight was, and Max was arguing about how great Harry Potter was. And Max said... Bella's like, Twilight's amazing because, you know, Bella Swan loves... Edward Cullen and Max went, oh, God, Bella. Twilight. No, what was it? She said, Harry Potter. No, Twilight. Because he thinks Harry Potter is amazing. And he was like, Harry Potter teaches girls to be smart and amazing and get boys out of trouble. And Twilight teaches girls to fall in love with men.
Oh, he's a young feminist.
And we all went, you he's got to you there. I know it took a long time to get that story out, but it was worth it.
We're just cutting to a musical break right now.
Fighting for your rights. Zin of Zen Tights.
And Bella was just there going, yeah, but Bella's got the same name as me.
Yeah, exactly.
She's her mother's daughter, isn't she? And then when I always liked Xena Warrior Princess, because the actress was called Lucy, so I was like, yeah, Lucy Lawless, that's my name too, really.
But if I do this, how much do I look like I'm stepping from the stool?
This is Wendy, who
fell from the stool.
Valerie's done a very good stand up there.
Xena, she does.
Tell you what, we'll take a picture of that, we'll tweet that.
I'm not pirouetting, but I'm just sort of gently turning
a strong but gentle turn, yeah,
like Xena.
Very good. I did
a triathlon 2 months ago.
Did you?
Yes, I did, and I feel there's an element of Xena running through my veins. Wow. Right now.
You are strong, you are powerful, you are woman, here you roar. This is exactly what we wanted to talk about, because the first thing that I was going to set up is that there is an International Women's Health and Fitness Day. And it's only in America at the moment, but I feel we will adopt it over here. Yeah. And it's a day to remind women that...
like Halloween.
Exercise. Yeah, exactly. It all comes over here eventually. And women will have to go from house to house trick-or-treating for kale and power smoothies.
And Kia seeds.
Yeah, Kia. Is that
quinoa.
How you say it?
I don't know.
No, it's
chaya.
Quinoa.
I want to say chaya.
Quinoa.
Quinoa is a different thing, isn't it? Kia seeds are a superfood.
Chia chaya. Yeah.
Okay. Chia chaya, whatever it is.
Healthy things that they are. And so someone has compiled a list of 7 inspirational female athletes who's always on commitment to health and fitness is an inspiration to many, and I thought this would be a great list for us to add to. So Serena Williams,
totally
number one on their list, which you were saying, Valerie, there's a documentary that I have missed.
Yeah, there's a fantastic documentary, and it's really about, I suppose in a way it's about the dad, because you know there's this wonderful kind of clip of him and with Serena and Venus when they're just little girls in the projects in Los Angeles. They're like downtown LA. And, you know, the camera goes into Serena and she must be about 9 or 10.
About 9 or 10, I've seen
this. And the camera says to her, you know, listen, you know,
the camera doesn't say it. It's like the interviewer that says it.
says the lady who fell from the stool about 10 minutes ago. And the camera to us, the cameraman says, a woman, of course, says, you know, who do you want to be like? You know, who, what athlete do you want to be like? And then it cuts to all the kind of images of her and her sister just like slogging it out at Wimbledon, all the rest of it, winning all the titles. And then it cuts back at the end of this brilliant trailer. And she says, you know, who do I want to be like? I don't know. I want, who does someone else want to be like? I want someone to be like me.
Oh.
You know, and she's just a child.
Yeah.
And so you see this vision that she has of herself and this belief that she has in herself. And they came from, you know, like tennis is just such a money game. It's like the Vegas of the sports world. And they were, he was building them, and they were there. And she's such an inspirational lady, I think. Both of them,
yeah.
both sisters, extraordinary.
It is an amazing
story,
isn't it? And the level of racism that they have had to put up with. Did you see they went back to the site of a tournament where they'd been quite shabbily treated?
Mm.
And, you know, and that the tennis establishment, it's like golf. It's all of those sort of very
totally.
Moneyed sports that it's taken
yep.
so long
yep.
for them to realise that, oh, maybe there is a problem with
yeah.
sexism and racism and
Absolutely.
Classism.
And also the fact that they went back. I mean, I don't know about you, but to have the nuts to go back to somewhere where they treat
you,
because normally
where you've been booed and
do you know what I mean?
Jeered and
I've had the odd unsuccessful gig. I'm not going back there.
I'm never doing the British Association of House Builders annual dinner again.
No,
I'll tell you that.
Don't get me started on that holiday camp in Hyde where they just didn't like me. I'm not going back there because I just felt so humiliated and embarrassed. But to go back there where not only you felt humiliated and embarrassed, but people booed you. I think
I know, but Wendy, you're going back there when you've won the Academy Award.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
No, but that's, but you know, you but, know. But you've won the Academy Award, but it's also like the judgment was passed on your skin colour. So, you know, how do you come back? The one, sorry, I interrupted you there because I thought that the one you were talking about was the interview where Venus Williams was interviewed, and a guy said, so how do you think you're going to win? And she's like, I'm just going to win, I'm confident. He's like, you seem very confident, how are you going to win? She's like, I'm going to win. He's like, well, you're very confident for such a young girl. And her father waded in the interview and said, excuse me, she's answered your question at 12.
Yeah, she's a child.
She's a child, and you're challenging her on that. And then it was such a great moment when you go, yeah, right enough. Only when her dad challenges, when you go, right enough.
Yeah,
here's an interviewer challenging a baby.
And I think as well,
why
there's
they
so
believe
much
themselves.
Kind of, there's so much sort of My Little Pony, that kind of, you know, scraped back blonde hair, and I'm not being kind of blondest or whatever you want to call it, you know, about hair colour, but this kind of idea that it's sort of a white middle class, you know, sport, and, you know, these gals, these girls from like the projects in LA, you know, digging down and hitting with their dad and coming through. It's extraordinary. And actually, I think in a way, and I know we're talking about women, but as a Scot, watching Andy Murray, you think he was from Dunblane. You know, his mum used to say that it was raining outside, which it often is in Dunblane in Scotland, and she would tape cereal packets, cereal boxes, cornflake boxes and things to her son's hands and say to them, hit a ping pong across the kitchen table. You know, these people were grafting and working and trying to achieve excellence, and I think there's so much value in that, you know, because we're living in such a kind of throwaway time, you know. It's like,
exactly.
You got that app, you know, hey, I got a score of 12,043, you know, I'm winning. You know what, actually, you're not. Apple is winning, or, you know, whatever is winning, you know.
And
will
really
I said,
hard work is, I mean, also the thing I love about Andy, and I mean, was it you I was talking to someone recently about my deep and abiding love for both Andy and Judy.
And Judy.
You know, that
they
are an amazing family, and you know, and he's just, he has never, you know, he doesn't fly off the handle as much as he could with all the shit that he takes, with all the negativity that's thrown at him, and he still just goes out and does the job. And it's just that is the thing about sport. You just go, you can prove it on the field. You can just
absolutely.
But also, not even sport, I think the thing is, Andy Murray came on the scene when he was a kid. Now, if I came on the scene when I was a kid, I would be a prize twat. And some might say I'm still a prize twat. But he didn't, you know, he wasn't comfortable with the media. And you look at like someone like Jeremy Corbyn, who hasn't been trained in the media, but is saying what he wants to say. And, you know, some of the stuff that he was, you know, quoted on yesterday was about how his his speech was fluffed and it wasn't as clean and pure as it should have been. You're like, oh, come on. Mm. And I quite like the fact that he's not been media trained. And you get Andy Murray coming on the scene as a kid who's grumpy and cross because he lost a match. And you're like, if I was 16 or 17, I was grumpy and cross when I lost a sock.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Fair enough. And then all of a sudden he's like, oh, yeah, he's got better now. You're like, of course, because he's what some might call growing up.
Yeah.
And he's still grafting 15 hours a day in a way that none of us were.
Yeah.
Unless you count, you know, drinking from dawn till dusk grafting, in which case I have put in my time.
Or, as you say, sort of high scores on Sonic the Hedgehog. I mean, you know, I've had achievements in my time. It just turns out they were all quite transient.
We have done well.
They're all quite fleeting.
In terms of remembering boys' names, that's not it.
Yeah. Lists of people you've snogged. That, you know, it's... I would never have put Andy Murray and Jeremy Corbyn together, but I do think there is a kind of a backlash against style over content and about easy success. And because tennis, when I was sort of first aware of it, it was all about, for the male tennis players, it was about the game, and for the female tennis players, it was about what knickers they wore and their sponsorship deals.
And,
Maria Sharapova being the most famous tennis player in the world, even though she wasn't the best.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we are sort of, there is a bit of a backlash against that now.
It is work, because my ex-husband, when he was a teenager, he looked pretty similar to Boris Becker. So he spent his teenage years signing autographs as Boris Becker, and I'm pretty sure scooping up the cast-offs of those ladies who thought he might actually be Boris Becker.
I love the fact that your sort of Jewish London ex-husband was pretending to be the German tennis player Boris Becker.
Turns out in a cupboard no one knows the difference.
Because the Venus and Serena story is incredible. Although, actually, saying that, tennis, if I think of my early sporting heroes, it would have been Martina Navratilova, Steffi Graf.
I loved her.
Actually, they were quite incredible because tennis was the only sport I had any aptitude for whatsoever, and I say that I was rubbish, but it was one you could practice on your own if you were slightly lonely.
And I think it's that thing that you said about, you know, kind of like female superheroes, and all we're laughing about Thelma and, you know, powers of deduction, everything, and Scooby-Doo, but actually, you know, with tennis, it's a gladiator role arena. You know, you stand in front of one other person, you know, it's a chess match, but you have a tennis racket in your hand and you have to outplay the other person. The rules are very clear. Mm-hmm. It's just you versus that other person. You know, there's a real element to it of kind of drama and challenge. And I'm hugely respectful of the people who've done it and been successful, because there are a zillion people who pick up tennis rackets and say, I'm going to do it. And actually they can't. And I've got two sons. I was talking to Wendy. I was at a tournament with my youngest son in Germany, and he was playing this tournament with children from all over the world. And it was extraordinary to see him go out and literally fight.
Oh my gosh, I bet your heart was in your mouth.
It was a really, really emotional thing. And I'm very proud of it. And it's a very sort of clean game, and it's an interesting game. So I think that is definitely one thing where you can see, you know, talent come through and personality, and it's bound by the rules. So there's something very fair about it as well.
It's extraordinary what your kids are. I find that as an adult, you don't really know what you're up against. Mm. But when you have children, you see.
Yeah.
You see exactly what the world is throwing at you and what you're capable of.
Yeah.
And it's so bizarre, like you saying, watching your kids playing tennis in that gladiatorial atmosphere. You see, like, some people thrive on that and some people don't. And you want to save the child that doesn't thrive on that. Mm. And you want to shove the child out there that does thrive on that. Yeah. And often the ones that thrive on that don't know that they thrive on that. And it's extraordinary. Yeah. And I remember doing an ad. I think you've all seen that I did a Rice Krispie advert with my children.
Yes.
And
adorable.
What was really interesting about that is acting is not just about being a great actor in terms of feeling stuff. It's about the technicality. As you'll know, Valerie, you'll have seen people who are like, you're like, oh my God, I don't get what they're doing. And then when you see them on screen, they're amazing.
Brave choices.
Brave choices, but it's not only that, it's technically standing in the right place so that the focus is in the right way. Yeah. And we did this advert, and my daughter, Isabella, was great at putting the Rice Krispie packet in the right place and angling it in the right place and saying the right thing at the right time. My son was really great at the just riffing and making the whole crew laugh, and it was funny and it was interesting. Mm-hmm. But in actual fact, what fitted the commercial better was my daughter hitting the right spot and doing the technical stuff right. So it's like when someone's great at something, whether it's tennis, whether it's acting, whether it's being a gladiator, it's the perfect marriage of technicality with talent.
Yeah. Can I tell you a heartbreaking story about my husband?
No.
So, that's true. Justin, when he was about, I think he was about 12 or 13, and he was somewhere on holiday, and there was some kind of tennis competition, and his mum said, "Oh, look, sweetheart, there's a little tennis competition that you could go and play in. Why don't you go and be in the tennis competition?" And
my husband is a very sweet, kind, gentle, lovely man.
He's not an athlete, and I am prepared to go on record and say that, and I don't think he would contradict me in any way. And he went out to do this little tennis competition, and it turns out, of course, that it was like some kind of tennis academy. And so he was in this tennis competition, and the 5 and 6 year old children were handing him his arse in every single round of this. And he said, and they were all really arrogant as well, because they all had that sort of gamesmanship, and they're like being already coached to win, to succeed. And poor Justin, he was already, he's 6'5" now, and he was a big lad even then, and he said that he had to try and get off the court before he could have a little cry because all these kids were, I mean, this is why you think it is, it's a tough old world, and if you are tough enough to survive it, you deserve plaudits for that.
It's a really tough world,
so we've got
it?
the list of inspirational athletes that we have been looking at. There was Serena Williams, mixed martial arts pro Ronda Rousey, who I don't know, but I have to say
Ronda Rousey is quite successful because my husband pointed her out in Entourage. She's in Entourage because Ronda Rousey is very successful. She's like a, you'll see her,
yes,
and you'll know
that
who
rings
she
a bell
is
now.
And she's really fit, and when I say fit, I mean fit as an athletic and fit as a fit. I totally would even though I'm straight as far as I know.
She's pictured here, actually, in boxing gloves, saying...
She's beautiful.
You have to have fear in order to have courage. I'm a courageous person because I'm a scared person. It's a good quote, isn't it?
That's great. But then, as you're a stand-up, you'll know exactly what that means.
Exactly that, exactly. That the fear is what drives you, and then the strength is what
and
keeps you there.
Despair is what makes you carry on into the next gig.
The need to feed yourself and clothe yourself.
I need to fix this.
Here's another inspirational quote. This is another inspirational female athlete. Long-distance swimmer Diana Nyad. She says the body is pathetic compared to what we have inside us. Again, it's all about mental strength and fortitude, isn't it?
I remember meeting you after I did the marathon, and I remember one of the boys saying to me in that pub, I just thought if it wasn't working out for me, I'd just stop running. And I remember thinking, oh, that didn't occur to me as a thought. I thought if it got painful, I'd walk. I did the idea of not completing the marathon didn't occur to me. And a friend of mine said, ah, that's because you've had a baby. And once you commit to having a baby, you have to see it through to the end. There is no opt out. You can't go at 6 months. Do you know what? Nah.
I did ask if the whole thing could be just dealt with in some other way. About 3 hours into labour, I was like, surely this week we could just, let's all just call this quits.
But it's interesting, right? It didn't even occur to me as an option to back out.
Yeah, you just can't. Gabby Douglas, all-star gymnast. She says, my goal is to continue to dig deep and work hard. Good for you, Gabby. There's women's soccer champ Alex Morgan. Amazing, female footballers now are. I met a woman the other day who is a kind of as close as you can get to being a professional women's footballer.
There are lots of professional women's footballers.
I don't think you make a lot of money, but
it's the fastest growing sport in the world.
But also, Lucy, quite an inspiration in terms of female stand-ups, because you were one of the first stand-ups that I knew that were out there being a woman and being a stand-up.
That's very sweet of you to say. I was sort of hoping you were going to say in terms of being an athlete.
And do you know what? You're a mental athlete, and I don't mean a crazy one. But honest to God, though, because like, there weren't many females, and there's other stand-ups that have been a bit more gung-ho about getting there, but you've always been amazing at, like, because you there wasn't many female stand-ups when you started. You
Well, I always cite the example of Jo Brand as someone who, like, she was the big inspiration to me and was just taking so much shit when I started doing stand-up. I found, in fact, the other day an article from the Manchester Evening News where they interviewed me when I was first doing stand-up, and they interviewed a couple of other women as well. Carolina Hearn was one of them and someone else, and the interviewer is kind of going, oh, it's great, there's all these new female comics who aren't man-hating like Jo Brand, and they're not harsh and vulgar, and they're, you know, they're not afraid to be feminine. And all of us in the interview go, no, don't slag off Jo Brand. This is not, you know, we're not doing a new women's kind of comedy. And it's like, this happens every now and then where they kind of go, and music as well, you see this in music, where they go, oh, finally, there are some women doing music and this, and you go, yeah,
oh, finally there are more journalists who aren't doing their research. Amazing.
Exactly. So yeah, it's, but yes, I have to say,
I'm paying you a compliment athletes. On the radio, because I won't do it to you in real life.
I know, I love you too from behind the security
whatever.
Of the microphone.
Don't tell anyone that I'm nice to you.
So we are going to invite our esteemed listeners, who are always very good at this sort of thing, to tweet in with their favourite, I mean, they'll obviously be famous because we love it. Well, not famous. People who have inspired you athletically. Paula Radcliffe, I think, is incredible. She's always been someone that I've thought that's, you know, in terms of endurance, both of career and physically in long distance running, maybe.
She's amazing.
So, yeah, I would like to hear from anyone who has any other female athletes that they admire. And mental athletes. You can have Thelma from Scooby-Doo again, if you want. You know, let's just have her every week. So that's going to be our list of the week. We're going to have a record now, and then we're going to come back and talk some more.
Let's have Wendy's choice of record. Wendy, can you remember what it was? And if you can, would you like to introduce it?
I wanted to introduce the song because it was a song that when I first met my husband, who was a boyfriend, who was meant to be a fling. He was a boyfriend at the time, turns out. He's a long-term love winner. And I didn't believe that he really loved me. And I listened to this a lot of the time.
I love a record of the story.
Lucy Porter Show on FUBAR Radio.
Ah, yeah, we were all sitting there enjoying that song, contemplating love and romance, and then the Lucy Porter sting came in to ruin the whole thing. That is a beautiful record, and that's a lovely... It was like an R tune. We just did an R tune, didn't we? That's
a
beautiful
thing. Let's just stop
thing.
For a second, Lucy, and listen to Wendy opening her can of gin and tonic.
No, I'm not drinking. For the whole of September.
Can we just
raise money for cancer?
Okay, it's technically almost October. Let's hear it.
No, Lucy can open her gin and tonic.
And I will do it. We'll do it in the appropriate hour.
Oh,
there
we
go. All right, then.
Yes,
and that is a beautiful... I tell you what was lovely about that is that particular Feist song, they did a Sesame Street version which helps you to learn to count.
Oh.
So, I mean, that the original version is lovely, but the Sesame Street version also educational.
But I have to say, I think... Because I met my husband when I already had two kids, so we watched that with the kids, and it's... It's weird being a single mother when you meet someone and you try to sort of move on with your life without going, yeah, cool, do you want to see me on a Saturday and we can go to the kids' screening of... No, it's not really a date. But then I remember watching that with Stephen and him going, oh, that's so cute. You're going, yeah, and the kids can watch it too and you're not going to think I'm a total mental.
I know, it's how you know they're a keeper.
It's a weird one. It's a weird one when you meet somebody and you've already...
See, I like the fact that you've got an R song, because I haven't...
song. We have a My Song. We have a My Song. I'm not saying it's his song, too.
Oh, okay, yeah. No.
I think it's important
have
to remember...
Have you got an R song, Lucy?
Well, we've got a terrible... it's not a terrible song, but it's quite a weird one. It's called Dick a Dum Dum.
I love it.
Written by Jim Dale, who you may remember from the Carry On movies and Doctor movies.
Just give me a little riff of it.
Dick-a-dum-dum-a, dick-a-dum-dum-ba, oh, dick-a-dum-dum-a, dick-a-dum-dum. Gotta go to Piccadilly, gotta Piccadilly, have a day to do it on. And it's all about, it's like a swinging 60s song. Where he goes to the King's Road and he picks up women, basically. It's all about a promiscuous man.
It's actually the polar opposite of what you've been talking about, female athletes really, isn't it?
Do you have a song with your husband,
Barry? Yeah, I've got...
What's your song?
Well, it's Benny Hill then, to follow on. I've just got to keep going on this because we're just like drowning ourselves.
But Valerie's husband's a pretty famous... When I was at university in Glasgow, we used to go to the Sub Club, and there was two pretty famous DJs called Oscar and Harry at the Sub Club. And Valerie is married to one of the famous DJs.
Wow. Do you get to go in the booth and everything?
I know. But I was such a lightweight because I was at drama school and I was just such a kind of swat because I love going to drama school, and so I never took any kind of bad substances of any kind.
What a
you know,
dick.
I would just kind of, I know, I would just sort
good
of
evening
sit.
And welcome to not enjoying the bonuses.
I would be thrown at drama school, and it'd be like 11 o'clock at night, and there'd be like some kind of mad party happening downstairs, and I'd be up in one of the rooms, kind of going, red lorry, yellow lorry, red
lorry. Lorry, lorry.
I suspect that you were probably
that was prior to meeting me.
I was prior to meeting Wendy. No, I was just such a good girl. And so when I met my husband, I just didn't ever go to the Sub Club, or I didn't do clubs and things like that. And he liked that, and I liked him. And, you know, it's, yeah, so
nice.
That was lovely.
You see?
I did go to the Sub Club, and it was awesome. So all the bad times, all the good times that you missed out on, I was there.
It's nice. You can fill her in on what she was missing at the time. Well, yeah. It was good. Obviously, it did you well, concentrating, because, you know, you've been nominated for a BAFTA, etc. And
very
will you tell me, can we talk about Outlander?
Outlander was amazing. I mean, I did Outlander last year. We filmed it up in the Cairngorms, and my kind of stuff was in a village that was is an actual kind of, it's a museum, in fact. And we had to have we had to be sort of screened before we went in, because you're not allowed to take on any kind of modern substances, because it's the thatched roofs and it's with peat on the roofs and things like that. I don't mean one of the gaffers, I mean an actual material from the earth. And and you know, that was it. It was lovely. So yeah, so I did that, and I had a few scenes with Katrina Balfe, who is wonderful. And it was very special, and obviously it means a lot to a lot of fans around the world, and so it was a great privilege to be in it, because in fact last season there weren't a lot of female characters in it at all. So it was a lovely thing to be given the opportunity to go on set and do that, you know, and go back in time. And it really felt like, I mean, they brought in supporting artists.
It's 18th century, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just turned the century. And we went on, and we're all in kind of like, you know, big sort of, you know, tweedy skirts and aprons and things like that, and I went on set, and they had set the supporting artists up already, and they were all kind of sitting around this table in my, in inverted commas, cottage. And you know, they're all sort of sitting there holding babies and things like this, and you go in, it's like it was lit so beautifully. It just looked like a Bruegel painting, or like a work of art, just extraordinary. And you know, you go in and do the scene, and it's a great privilege when you're an actor and you get to go back in time and do something that's period, because you know, you really do, the people who are working in the film industry and television industry and are doing that kind of stuff are just total experts in their fields, and they're literally recreating something that you could only imagine, you know, it's in your dreams. And you get to walk on to that dream and see your lines and be that character. So it's a great, great privilege.
And
you know,
what's nice as well is that, because period drama for a while, and it still persists a bit, is normally posh big house period drama of the Downton Abbey and Pride and Prejudice kind of thing. And so to see something else recreated so beautifully and lovingly is really thrilling, isn't it? And it is it's an enormous show. It's an enormous
Incredible.
Worldwide phenomenon.
Yeah, I don't think when we were shooting it, I mean, I was in it for like Blink and You Miss Me kind of type of thing, but I think the actors who are doing it, Bill Paterson, Bill had to,
I absolutely worship him.
He's doing Waiting for Godot at the moment with Brian Cox in the Lyceum in Edinburgh.
Why don't we all go? Let's all go to Edinburgh.
Let's go now.
a group trip.
Foobar group trip. Everyone's welcome.
But you
listeners.
Know, he was sort of drafted in when we were filming. They had just said to him, listen, we've decided to kind of extend your character, you're going to be on the back of this kind of sort of horse, this kind of pony, walking around all the different villages. He was a sort of tax collector, and they decided, and he was terribly uncomfortable. I mean, they had to kind of pack hot water bottles around his costume and things, because you're out in the Cairngorms, it's very cold.
You said costume, my head was going somewhere else when you start going, oh. Sorry, I'm a bad girl.
But you know, it's just it's a really special thing actually, and people come in and out of it. It's just very special. And I actually had to sing a Gaelic song in it, and I had learned it. I couldn't believe it. I went to Gaelic lessons. I learned this song. I thought I'm going to do it. You know, they're making it's how they used to make sort of fabric tweed. They used to pee on it, and then they used to stretch it, and they would sing a Gaelic song when they were sort of, as it were, sort of mulching the fabric and stretching the fabric. So I learned this song, and I turned up on set, and I was like so proud of myself. And the director called me, Brian Kelly, called me 2 days before, and he said, Valerie, listen, I'm really sorry. I mean, you'd never think there was going to be a copyright issue with this, but we can't go with that song. Cut to Valerie's face turning white, hair dropping on the floor. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, you have to learn another song. And I said, I will do my best. I turned up in the Cairn Gorms. They brought in the supporting artists who were all Gaelic speakers. And I just said to them, listen, girls, I'm going to do my best. Help me. Because that's all you can do in a situation like that. You can't go in and say, hi, you know, I've learned my part. And I was like, I am free falling here. Just give me, you know, help me. And they were fantastic. And so, you know, we didn't have to learn another song. It was very difficult. A big challenge. I didn't expect it. But you get thrown things a lot in these things. And Katrina was so lovely and so helpful, you know, on that. She just said, she was amazing, actually. I remember coming off and I was like a little bit teary because I felt I screwed up one of the takes. And she said to me, what you're doing is so hard. I couldn't do it. And I think you're doing brilliantly. She was very supportive, lovely lady. So for any Outlander fans listening who already like her, I can tell you what a wonderful supportive person she is. She's
Do you know
terrific.
What it sounds amazing. You know, I'm desperate to have a part in it now. I can't speak I can't even do a Scottish accent, but I'm sure
well,
if there could be
France now. They've moved into France.
They?
Yeah, the show is moving around.
I can't do that accent either, but I'm not going to let that eventually it will come to Croydon. Eventually there'll be Croydon in the 1700s and I am in.
I remember calling up once, you know, like that sort of glorious sort of confidence of youth when you don't realise what you're up against. And I remember reading that a production company that I'd worked with had bought the rights for Charlotte. I'm really embarrassed to tell the story.
Get on with
but
it.
But I'm going to go with it. The production company bought the rights for Charlotte Gray, and I called up thinking, Charlotte Gray, that's about a Scottish spy. I'm from Edinburgh, and I speak French. I did French at university, I speak French. And I called up and went, hi. I'm Wendy. I'm an actor. You might have seen me in Taggart and other lesser-known popular shows. I can speak French. I'm from Edinburgh. So, you know, what about Charlotte Gray? The producer said to me, thanks for your call, but we have... if I can only remember her name in the punchline.
Was it Kate Blanchett?
We have Kate Blanchett in the title role. And I was like, okay, thank you, love you. Bye, 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 bye.
That bitch always gets my work.
Kate Blanchett and her talent.
But she is so extraordinary.
She
and
is
I love
extraordinary.
That thing. I love that.
So are you, Wendy?
She's not Scottish and she doesn't speak French.
But
I'm just going to put that out there. She may be amazing, Valerie.
No, but the thing about Kate Blanchett is she transcends all of us, doesn't she? She's just kind of, and I love that quote Jeremy Northam made of her when he did a show play with her. Was it something like the importance of being earnest or something?
It
was an Oscar Wilde movie that they shot, and he said the thing about Kate Blanchett is, because Jeremy Northam is so gorgeous, such a gorgeous guy, and he said she's very married. And I think she just loves her husband, and that's it. And there's never been anything beyond that about her and Andrew Upton, I think it is. A friend of mine knows them and has dinner with them in Sydney, and says they're just completely in love. What a lovely couple.
That just reminded me of a little story that I was going to talk about. There is some relevance, so bear with me. It's about Prue Leith, the famous restaurateur and author.
Yeah.
And she was talking at a book festival, and she says the secret of her success was that she had an affair. My affair helped me build a business, says Prue Leith, according to the Times. But
I'll tell my husband.
I know, but this is such a great. We need to cut this out and take it home to our husbands and say, "Listen, darling," because she basically was having an affair with Rain Kruger, broadcaster and playwright, who was living with his first wife when they began their relationship. And so she was having this affair, but she said it was the way that she could establish her business. So he went home at night so I could work every hour. I'm not proud of the fact that I had a long affair, but it did help the business, she said at the Henley Literary Festival. So that's just, I just thought I'd put that out there.
Was her affair was with her work. It wasn't with a man.
No, well, her affair was with the man, but it was good having an affair rather than trying to build a normal relationship, because it meant that she knew that he would go home and then she'd have all that time. She wasn't having to sleep over.
I know, but I think the thing is,
so she had more time. Do you see what I mean? So she's saying,
so did she fuck a man or did she fuck a business?
She she fucked a man in order to build her business. Yeah, so she would rather have that kind of.
So just so we're clear, who do I have to fuck so that my mortgage gets paid off?
Prulies.
Wendy. Wendy, your mortgage. All right, I'm not allowed to say. The thing is, I mean, don't you think intimacy is intimate? You know, like if somebody says nothing happened. No, I think it's the thing. I think, you know, nothing happened, but we just slept in the same bed. I think you sleep, you go to sleep with someone. You wake up the next day, you have shared your dreams almost.
Well, and that is where the effort...
I've had sex with someone, you know...
That's where the effort comes in, and I see what Prulith is saying, is that the effort is all about building a relationship and being there and, you know, and not having to have that emotional intimacy, just having a sort of sexual affair that may later, as it did for her, blossom into something else.
I think I'd be more upset if my husband had an emotional relationship. Like, even if he didn't sleep with somebody, I'd be more upset if he had an emotional connection with someone who he shared his hopes and dreams with.
Yeah, that would last week we had Tanya Edwards on, and she was exactly the opposite. She was like, you can have as many emotional connections as you want, but sex is the point where I think she said she was going to cut his dick off.
On that note,
I always think that's interesting when saying if he did that, I'd cut his dick off, because I always think of Cheryl Cole going, well, if Ashley Cole fucked around on me, I'd cut his fucking balls off, and we're all still waiting. Come on,
revenge
Cheryl.
Is a dish best
you
served cold,
promise, Cheryl. We're all waiting.
It needs
However,
to be televised.
Can I just say that Wendy gets her hair done in the same salon as Cheryl?
It's gorgeous, and I was absolutely going to say that.
I was in there for, they do a kind of walk in blow dry, and I was going for a meeting for something, and I popped in, and I was chatting to a lovely girl, and she said, oh, you know, she said the news is just broken because Cheryl's had her hair cut off, and her guy upstairs has done it, and I said, oh. What's she like? And she said she's great. She said, but her husband is really fussy about food, and she said, you know, he just loves like sort of grilled fish and vegetables, and he just doesn't. And obviously you can see that Cheryl and him are
both fussy
dinner.
About food.
Well, this is how the other half lives. You eat at the hairdressers. I don't think my hairdresser would know, you know, the woman at Supercuts in Watford, she's got no idea.
my hairdresser for a laugh sent me there was a money off voucher at my hairdresser, and I have a joke about I don't know if you've seen my joke about extensions where I say, you know, Cheryl, your hair hasn't got its mojo back. You're wearing the hair of a third world child, because that's exactly where extensions come from, we all know. So when that came, they had a special offer on extensions of my hairdresser, and my hairdresser thought it would be hilarious to send me Cheryl's offcuts, because of course as soon as Cheryl got her bob done, he was like, do you want Cheryl's tails?
You could sell those, nice. Surely.
You get away from me. with your no sympathy for poor children hair, I'm not interested.
But Lucy, don't you think it's creepy? I mean, that whole idea of, you know, you could sell that, the idea of like bits of someone become have a value, you know, like the idea of, you know, I've got John Lennon's, you know, kind of bloodied shirt from when he was you know, why?
Wasn't there Britney Spears pregnancy test? I'm sure there was a Britney Spears pregnancy
My
test.
My favourite thing ever was when I went to Cuba. There's a museum in Cuba, and there's a museum of the revolution, and one of them is, you can see Che Guevara's socks that he was wearing when they caught him, and it literally looks like, you know, those expandable socks that you can buy that fit from size 12 to size 10. And they've cut. Excuse my burping. Thank you for letting that go, Valerie. But they're like pinned up on the wall.
You could sell that.
Yeah. Just wait till I get as famous as Cheryl, and you can sell my burp. They've got these socks pinned to the wall with a couple of holes in them. Like someone sat with sort of a few holes and gone, here you go, that's the socks Shay was wearing when he was arrested and shot to shit.
Wendy, I've heard enough. It's not that interesting. Socks, it was good, but up to point. I just want to say that one of the rooms that's fantastic, Lucy, just let me go and I'll finish on this, is, have you ever been to the treasure room at the British Museum? Oh, no, not the British Museum, the British Library, because people think British Library, lots of books, I'm not going, too many books, but they've got a treasury room, a room of treasures, and you go in and they've got the first manuscript of Beethoven, one of Beethoven's symphonies. They've got the lyrics of Yesterday written on the back of an envelope, the original that John Lennon and Paul McCartney, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's an absolute joy, that room. So in terms of selling things like Cheryl's offcuts, before you do that, go to the Treasury Room in the British Library and see what you
might
be up
against. Proper treasure. That's proper.
Absolutely.
Do you know the there was a thing in the papers today about the Jack the Ripper Museum? Have you seen this? The most. I mean, I want to go, but I don't want to go. But so it was meant to be. I think they initially got the funding saying it's going to be a very sensitive. It's a museum to look at the role of women in the East End, and they sort of built it up to be this kind of feminist place. And then it's opened, and it is a proper kind of Hammer House of horror.
Yeah.
You know, you go into the sound of screaming women. But the thing that really made me laugh about it is that they have set up, this is what Jack the Ripper's room looked like. And you're like,
I was always wondering about that.
That is amazing. Given that nobody else in the world seems to know who Jack the Ripper was, and you've managed to assemble, his personal artifacts, it's just hilarious.
It's a great bit by Patricia Cornwell. Have you seen the Patricia Cornwell book about Jack the Ripper?
No,
she's decided that it was the prince.
Oh,
I
right.
can't remember what prince.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
And yeah.
It was just, I should have, if I'd known you were going to bring that up, I would have done my research so that I could say.
The listeners can do that. The listeners can go and Google that.
As opposed to Wendy.
Patricia Cornwell's idea of who Jack the Ripper was really amazing, because like he left the palace, and then also there's all these police reports, and the police reports have drawn the picture of the crime scene, and it's exactly the same as like art. And it's just extraordinary.
Well, you see, so it's, I mean, it is a fascinating story. I just think making a kind of Disneyland of murdered prostitutes is probably a bit off.
Dismaland.
Yes, which I never got to see. That's closing, isn't it? Dismaland. Good, right. Well, I think we've segued very nicely there into another. In fact, you know what? It is Pim's hour now, isn't it? We're achingly close to Booze Hour. So let's have a little record to take us there. What shall we have, Amanda?
Shall we have your theme? Should we have your theme?
Lynn Collins. I'm gonna feel good.
Yeah.
That's me.
Okay.
There we go. Now that, what a record. What a tune, ladies and gentlemen.
What I love about it, Lucy, is just the way that she kind of summons like her concentration and her focus at the start.
Exactly,
That meditation she's asking from us at the start.
It's powerful, it's moving, it's beautiful, isn't it?
Has anyone bid anything for Wendy's burp? Yeah.
Oh yeah, please, let's get that out on the tweets.
Three donations of 20 quid on my...
What?
I had three donations of 20 quid on my...
£20 for a burp, that's very good. Cornwall's Sickert. Portrait of a Killer. Walter Sickert, the artist.
Sickert,
that's right. I knew about
Ripper.
That. Yes,
Sorry.
Yes, yes.
I got halfway through that. Do you ever get halfway through a sentence and you go, shit, I should have Googled this.
My brain is not giving me the stuff that I need. But well done for your speedy fingers, if not your speedy brain.
Patricia Cornwell thinks that the Jack the Ripper is Walter Sickert. And that's it's really interesting because lots of his pictures actually do match the police photographs.
Spooky.
Shall we play another record? I'm going to attempt another record.
Sorry, I thought the microphone was off. I do apologise. I thought there was a record playing right now.
There is no record playing right now.
Gosh, it's a good job.
On Foo Bar Radio.
Goodness me.
Okay, right. Now, let's see if this one's going to play ball. This is going to be Never Gonna Give You Up by Lynn Collins.
The Lucy Porter Show on Foo Bar Radio.
That's more like it, isn't it? Oh, now Wendy's just offered to do a new sting for us.
The Lucy Porter Show.
The Lucy Porter Show.
I think we might need a mellow one, Amanda.
Yeah,
I think we do.
Hey,
good evening and welcome to the Lucy Porter Show.
Yeah, that's
she
nice.
She is amazing.
There we
she?
Go.
Come
She's
on.
Look how versatile.
The
talent.
Versatile
I am.
Versatility.
She's all about the versatility. Now let me, I'm going to open my booze after that.
When I say versatile, I mean a bit of a dick.
I mean versatile.
That's her favourite phrase of the day. It's all you've said all day.
Good evening and welcome to this week. This week is brought to you by the letter D and by the phrase, a bit of a dick.
A bit of a dick. Oh, I tell you who's not a bit of a dick.
Who, Lucy?
We have had lovely Jane, who runs What the Frock Comedy in Bristol, is listening to the show. Hello, Jane.
Hello, Jane.
And she has nominated her sporting idol. And that woman is Catherine Switzer.
Ooh, good call.
Yeah, no, I had never heard of Catherine Switzer. Catherine Virginia Cathy Switzer. Can you tell I'm on Wikipedia right now having a look? She...
I love Wikipedia.
That's just amazing. This may or may not be true, but let's go with it. Because
let's go with
it. Yeah, you know, we've got it here. She was best known for being the first woman to run the Boston Marathon as a numbered entry in 1967. So she basically paved the way for female marathon runners.
Wow.
Has had an amazing... Born in Germany, the son of a major in the United States, United States Army.
The United States.
And ran the 1967 Boston Marathon after her coach insisted a marathon was too far to run for a, quote, fragile woman.
It's too far to run for anyone. Because after I ran a marathon, I was told that the first person who did it died.
Yes, right. Yes.
No one tells you that before you run it.
Yeah, in memory of that poor dead Greek guy. But Switzer trained for and completed the 1967 Boston Marathon under the entry number 261 with the Syracuse Harry... I've only just opened my drink and I'm already slurring my mouth. With the Syracuse Harriers Athletic Club. It was another 5 years before women were officially allowed to complete, and she did it in 4 hours and 20 minutes.
Complete or compete?
Compete.
Just checking.
Compete. I can say words.
Yeah.
So anyway, so she competed in the Boston Marathon, and she proved that the coach who insisted the marathon was too far for a fragile woman was a bit of a dick.
Oh, yeah.
Good evening and welcome to this week, where our letter is D and our phrase is bit of a dick.
So
Lucy, can I pull focus?
Yes.
Can you do that on radio? How do you do it on radio, pulling focus?
Make a really loud noise. Go.
No, Wendy's burped. I'm not going to top that.
Right. Let's be honest.
I was doing it privately and secretly, and you just pulled focus on that.
Well, see how you do it on radio. Thank you, Wendy.
Someone else throws focus on you. So,
Valerie. No, I just want to say I did a triathlon 2 months ago. Now, Wendy's going to say, so did I, but let's not listen to her. Let's talk to me.
I've never done a triathlon. You're amazing.
You had a glass and a half of wine after your gig today, and you said to me, I said I did my triathlon, and you said to me, yeah, I've done a triathlon too.
No, I've never done triathlon. I never said that.
Have you ever heard a voice that sounds like a 6-year-old more than like Wendy's voice right now? I've never done that. You did say, why are you doing that funny? She's doing funny things off. She's pulling focus in a way that radio can't. Okay.
But so marathons, triathlons.
How is a triathlon?
So triathlon is almost 1,000 metres swimming in open water. It's really hard. That's hard.
I bet.
Because you are with lots of big fish beside you in the shape of other women in wetsuits, absolutely crashing down, and you know your line of vision and everything, it's a nightmare. Then you come out the water and you're panting for breath, but you have to go run like 400 metres and collect your bike, and then you have to cycle for 20k, and then you have to run
20k?
That's
extraordinary. That's such a lot.
I couldn't walk that.
No, but £20,000. 20k.
Oh yeah, if they paid me that, I'd do anything. Yeah, fair enough.
No, 20 kilometers, and then you do like the running for like nearly 6k at Blenheim. It's tough.
Where was it? At Blenheim? Did you say
Blenheim? Was it Blenheim?
And I had to run through an estate. When I say an estate, I mean.
Okay, and let me just finish to say that I thought was interesting about it. People kind of said, "Oh, you know, do you want sponsorship?" And I hate the whole thing of sponsor. It's like I'm climbing Kilimanjaro. Can you give me some money? And I think actually, no. Save the money that you're going to spend on the flight and the equipment on running up and down the mountain, and put the money in yourself to the charity, and don't tell anyone about it. That's an interesting thing to do. Not, you know, I'm an athlete. Can you give me lots of money for doing a really good thing? No, you do it yourself and don't tell anyone about it. That is the dawn of the new age, I think.
You are just nails for nails' sake.
Sorry.
I'm talking. Yes. Is anyone with me? Anyone in the studio?
I'm sick of being asked to sponsor people.
Thank you. Let's just kind of high five right now. Can we make a slapping noise in the... Okay,
that was terrible.
There we go.
Let's pretend that was the slap. And there's guys, and
Valerie. There's a really less complex way to say I'm not sponsoring you.
You know, like my husband isn't going to shave his beard. Who cares? Shave his beard. I don't care. Can you sponsor him not to shave his beard? No, because you know what? Give it away and don't tell anyone. That is an act of charity.
I was watching this week was in the Pride of Britain Awards.
Yeah,
and they had the woman who started the Ice Bucket Challenge. Because I didn't realise it was just one woman who decided, her and her husband went, oh, this would be a fun thing to do. We'll just tip ice cold water over each other. And I mean, that is an amazing fundraising feat. Because I mean, the amount of money that that raised. And because when it first started, I was a bit sick of that. It's a difficult one, isn't it, with charity? Because you do, you know, ultimately you kind of think, well, yeah, just give some money to charity. Let's all just give money to charity. Mm. But then I think people do need a bit of a reminder and a fillip and a push to do it.
Because and if people don't really, though, like, I was talking about this with the kids the other day, that they were like, because obviously I wasn't drinking for a month for charity. Sorry about that, mate. She hasn't sponsored me, so there you go. That's why
I haven't sponsored you either, but to be fair, I didn't know. So I will know.
But I kind of feel like, and the kids were talking about why people do it, and I kind of feel like if you're doing something that benefits someone else, it doesn't really fucking matter why you're doing it. Just... something, and I appreciate that it annoys some people or whatever, but I kind of think, you know, if something good's happening at the end of it, who really cares?
Well, I think it's about, you know, helping an old lady across the road and asking to help lift the shopping bags. And
but
I think
it's small
acts.
It's not exclusive.
I know, I'm not saying it's
though.
Exclusive, but charities are, you know, there's massive amounts of money go into administration and go into the fees of charity, directors of charities and things. And it does make me laugh. You know, they get to walk around and kind of go, you know, yeah, I'm working for a charity. You know, you're on 150,000 quid and, you know, I'm bursting my guts, you know,
but
kind of like,
then,
you know,
I don't
running
know.
About a park.
I mean, I think that you could also argue that, yeah, you know, I mean, charity is now taking over from a lot of things that the state would have done. And, you know, the less that the state kind of helps people, then actually I think, well, I don't really have a problem with charities being run as businesses, because they need to raise such phenomenal amounts of money in a very difficult climate, and they do need to get into bed with corporations and all of those things that I am slightly squeamish about, oh, you know, it's, you know, this is all a very capitalist way of helping people, but then, you know, that is the way that the world's going, and you think, well, actually it has to be that way. And similarly, I think that people do need reminding that the thing that I do always do is I will always sponsor my mates a little bit when they're doing a thing, and you know, and but the main bulk of my giving is just standing orders, is just, you know, give people the money. Yeah. And but it does help to remind you about other charities.
As comics, we do a lot of, I mean, we don't do a lot of charity, we don't like to talk about it, but we do a lot of gigs.
A lot of benefit gigs.
We do a lot of benefit gigs. Yeah. A lot more than...
Sometimes I don't even know what they're for, if I'm completely honest. Like, people just feel really like, oh, I can do
happy.
This. This
I'm
is a very
really
easy thing I can
do
to raise
gigs.
Money.
I'm really happy to do benefit gigs, because I kind of go, do you know what? It sounds so crap. I've got a roof over my head. I'm always skint. But there's always people.
The people that are asking you to do the benefit gigs, are they doing it for nothing?
But that's not the point. Well, no, they're not. But that's not the point. For me, that is not the point. If we all lived in a society where we thought, well, you're asking me to do this and what are you doing? I think... I don't mind if people who are asking me to do it are earning more money than I am, as long as
okay,
I feel
so
like I'm doing
saying,
well. Comedy gigs are a funny little thing, though, because it's also there is a certain amount of egotistical gratification within doing it, and it is that feeling.
They really
of
shouldn't
I'm,
review you if you die in your arse.
No,
because I'm doing it for free.
Yeah, this is a charity gig. Well, I was talking to Joe Brand about this, and
you and your famous friends.
I know. I'm just going to name drop, just putting it out there, name dropping that. We have different opinions, because she was saying, oh, well, I always feel quite relaxed when it's a charity gig, because you go, well, it's a charity gig, you know,
I feel relaxed when it's a charity
whereas
gig.
I don't, I always feel like, oh god, no, but if I'm really shit, then I'm shit, the pandas may get to hear about it. I have terrible Catholic guilt.
Also, I think there's a terrible thing that's happening just now with people who are standing up. You think about how brave it is. I mean, I went to see Wendy today. She was working in front of a whole group of mums with babies.
This was Lucy's gig that she set up, this gig that I did today.
Okay.
That I so set Lucy's up and then walked away from. So okay. I didn't have to. Yeah, but it's...
But, you know, like you, what you do, you know, to stand up like that, so exposed. I mean, you could literally just die. You could be booed, you could be whatever. And you stand up and you give your talent. And I think that is just so brave to do that, and you've got people who are making someone has made £100,000 today in an office in Canary Wharf or whatever it is they are in the financial world, in inverted commas, and they're, you know, what have they done? What have they contributed? Wendy made mums laugh today. Wendy made people who literally were breastfeeding the children doing an incredible job for our society, and she gave them something. She connected to them. She made them feel good about themselves. She made them laugh at themselves. She made them laugh at her and her life. What an incredible gift. And I think, you know, there's such a, we're living in this climate where talent, this idea that can you do it for charity? Yeah, but what are you doing for charity? Mm. Well, you know, I'm controlling you and I'm asking you to do it for charity. Why? Because you're talented, but what are you doing? And there's this thing, there's this power change that's happening where people who are in jobs phoning up and saying to talent, because your talent is, we can kind of, it's mercurial, we can play with it, we can get it for nothing because it's cheap. You know what? It's not cheap. And that's the only thing I would say.
But I don't think charity gigs cheapen talent. I think that what cheapens talent is all the free stuff that you're asked to do that isn't for charity. Yeah, that's the real kicker at the moment.
We get quite a lot of people coming in going, can you, we're doing a, I don't know about you, Liz, but I get like called in for an advertising company saying, can we workshop an idea? Can we workshop an idea?
No.
And basically workshopping an idea means I give you my ideas and you go home and you collect your 50 grand salary. Yeah. I think that's more damaging. And also, do you know what? Today, there's I was reading a thing about what makes you, what feeds your soul. Mm. And what feeds your soul is meaningful work. Mm. So if you're doing work, whether it is, and they reckon that if you're a farmer in America and you have a yield once a year, whether it's corn, and you have once a year and you plant the seeds and you ignore it and you yield that corn once a year, that's not meaningful work. Mm. If you're a Chinese rice farmer and you look at the water and you grow the rice and there's lots more attention into that, it feels like meaningful work because you're actually doing something that not only feeds your yield, but it feeds you as well, because the attention is great for you. Mm. And today, yes, I'm like making loads of mums feel happy and funny. We're connecting and stuff. But also that gives me something back. And
it's a lovely thing to do.
You know, they're all laughing and they're going, and I'm talking about, God, you know, kids and this and that and that. But having, for me, the biggest thing about my job, yes, I'd love to be doing live at the Apollo and getting whatever they get, but I love
not
the
that much money, probably.
Well, probably not that much money, but I love the connection. You know, I know I was in Derby last week, and the week I was in Coventry, and but I have a lovely time because I connect with folk.
Yeah,
I know. And it's just so nice.
I know.
It's so nice.
I absolutely understand.
That sounds so crap of me.
No, it doesn't.
I just like my job because it's nice.
No, but
I'm skinned and happy.
No, but it's not about that. It comes back to that thing as well, I think, in a way, about kind of women. I mean, I've just been asked to stand in for someone who sadly is not very well on a show. It's called The School Run, and it's on at the Canal Cafe Theatre. It's sold out. It's a wonderful, wonderful show, and I'm sure it will run.
Give
again.
Give everyone the dates. So
No, but the point I was going to make, it was my pleasure and privilege to stand in for somebody because it's a fantastic show and it was wonderful they asked me to come in and do it. And I agree with you, you know, it's a wonderful thing to do and to share that and hear people laughing and everything. It's wonderful. But what I'm saying is I think we're living in a culture where talent in itself and actors and people who are creative is being denigrated.
I think you're right on that. I agree with that. Don't you agree with
and
that?
Yeah, and I think, you know, everything is too easily stealable and shareable and nickable, and it is, you know, but then we are going to have to deal with that as, I mean, again, sort of thinking as joke writers or as, you know, content providers or whatever, you know, we're now known as. That is hard because you go, well, that isn't going to change. You have to be prepared to put a lot of stuff out.
Who are you to ask me to be a content provider? I am the person who's, as it were, living in the garret, eating this and doing that. You are, you know, at Shoreditch House, you know, with a table, with an expense
account.
They're
not happy, though.
And whilst I agree with you,
I've been trying to convince myself they're not happy. No, they're living this shallow, empty lives.
Hang on. Whilst I agree with you saying that, what makes me happy is to provide content and to do that. And I also think for anyone that nicks any idea I have, I'm still coming up with ideas. And what makes me happy is to go and write. If I don't write every day, I feel a bit quashed. So yes, I understand that like talent is being pulled away and stuff is being happening, but at the same time, I still get to write and come up with ideas.
I know, this is the
lucky
problem, though.
Me.
We are kind of willing
You still get
dupes.
To be free. That's yeah. the thing. You're free. You don't have a boss.
I don't have a boss.
You know, you are your own boss.
Apart
you
from
know,
my three are, children who are like,
course,
Mummy,
yeah,
can you come and bring my PE kit to school right now?
And I mean, there is a boss at Fubar, but he's delightful.
He is delightful.
I don't think he really knows he's the boss, does he? I don't think he's really aware.
Really, yeah, he lets us run the show, really.
he's never listened to it in a delightful way.
I think he's probably in the pub, actually. Yeah, or he could be in the office. We'll probably see him.
Now, shall we? Now, they're very.
So we're just blabbing on here, aren't
well,
we?
Well, I love that, though. I think we've sorted that. Mm. That's charity done. Tick.
So that's charity
tick. Sorted out charity. Here's a thing that I was going to talk about. Women's Facebook fertility rant draws praise from thousands of women. And this was a thing that was in the Telegraph. And a woman called Emily Bingham has put on Facebook. She put a post on Facebook with a picture of an ultrasound scan. Mm. And next to it, she said, "Hey, everyone, now that I got your attention with this random ultrasound photo I grabbed from a Google image search, this is just a friendly PSA that people's reproductive and procreative plans and decisions are none of your business. None of your business! Before you ask the young married couple that's been together for seemingly forever when they're finally going to start a family, or blah-de-blah-de-blah, and then, and anyway, she goes on, or the parents of an only child toddler when their little brother or sister will be in the works, before you ask a single 30-something if or when she plans on having children, because you know the clock's ticking, just stop, please stop. You don't know who's struggling with infertility or grieving a miscarriage or dealing with health issues. You don't know who's having relationship problems or is under a lot of stress, or the timing just isn't right. You don't know who is on the fence about having kids or having more kids. You don't know who's decided it's not for them right now or not for them ever."
Absolutely.
And, absolutely, couldn't agree more.
I know, and it seems like a, you know, you go, yeah, surely that's a self-evident, you know,
well, you see,
correct
I have to
statement
say,
of fact.
I feel like that more now that I've had children, because I know the trials and tribulations of getting pregnant, of keeping pregnant, of staying pregnant, of no. I have to say, when I first had Isabella, my eldest, I gave birth to her. First of all, I was told I couldn't have children because I had various gynecological problems, and so when I was pregnant, it was a real shock to me that I was pregnant. And my school friends still joke about how I used to refer to my pregnancy as, you know, the infiltrator, and just I was just really awful about being pregnant for the first time. And then also having my daughter was obviously great, but I wasn't one of those people who looked at their babies and went, "Oh, I'm so in love." I kind of, the more I got to know her, the more I loved her. And yeah, of course, I'm very close to my daughter now. But I feel that everyone's experience is so personal. Mm. And I would never dream of saying to a newly married couple, "So what about babies?" Or to somebody who has a baby who's about two, because I know that's when the hormones kick in again and you think, "I might have another one." Because also I now know that so many babies don't make it to fruition because of miscarriages or difficult. So I'd never say having another one. But then I know, having had kids.
Yes, yeah, I wonder if
what's
I might
ahead.
Have
and I don't
it
know if I'd been more of a
or
selfish, thoughtless prick if I didn't know that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I
might be in that group.
I know,
of
you
going,
sort
so
of
what
think,
now?
Exactly, you know, it's before rushing to condemn people for doing it, you know. But then I suppose this is why it's good to get it out there and say it on Facebook and have however many 38,000 shares.
38,000.
But you know, I think that, you know, people are tribal, you know, human beings, you know, we all belong, we all see somebody and we think, "Are you in my tribe? Are you in my tribe?" You know, that's a kind of, it's almost an instinctive, intuitive, genetic thing that we just feel when we meet somebody. You know, Billy Connolly says, you know, in the first 5 seconds of meeting somebody, you think, you know, can I F them? Can I, you know, can I eat them? Can I sleep with them? You know, or whatever, it's the same thing, whatever it is. And, you know, it's just that thing that you think, can I fight them?
You're
not
using
the
word fuck.
Can
you use the word fuck?
I don't want to because,
you're
you know,
so sweet.
She's still that good girl who didn't take drugs. And
only on the radio.
She's a very good girl.
On the radio. So I think, you know, there's that element to it. And also, so I think when people say, it's like the same thing if someone says, "Oh, do you live in Broccoli?" You know, it's a tribal thing. It's like, "Are you going to have a baby?" You know, it's just a thing. thing that people say. I wouldn't say it to somebody now, but I might have said it 10 years ago to someone. Are you good? When are you going to have a baby? Just because it's a tribe. Are you in my tribe?
But also, you don't know how hurtful sharing. It is, because now you know that somebody could be going through a miscarriage as you ask that question. I know, so but I think, never do it.
But Wendy, I think that life is hurtful. Life is painful in many ways.
But you know that now. You wouldn't have known it when you were 20.
No, I know. But now I might not. Now someone might say to me, you know, where do you live? Or, you know, where do your kids go to school?
And that's really hurtful.
You know, people just, you know, life is full of inquisitive. Yeah, yeah. You know, people are nosy. We are designed. We are the human race. I mean, it's a race. You know, we're running. We're competing against each other. That's Darwin's theory, survival of the fittest, whether you like it or not. People will ask like these questions. I mean, I think it's interesting she's had all these shares. It's a great point. I totally agree with that. I think your private life is your private life. Your sexual life is your private sexual life. You know, nobody has a right. And I actually think it's an art form. And how do you deflect these questions? How do you... What's the art form of saying, actually, you know
best,
what?
The best tell ever.
I talk
Sarah
about it on stage all the time.
Amazing... routine.
Yes.
Just because I've seen it most recently.
Sorry, that's Sarah Pascoe. I interrupted because I talk about my sex life all the time on stage. I literally have no secrets. My husband's very upset about it.
I know.
But it's Sarah Pascoe is great.
Well, hers
about
is quite
it.
A sort of confessional thing as well. And I hate doing other people's material because I could never do it justice.
Oh, I do yours all the time.
So go and see her. But it is a very good thing because she does a thing about people saying to her, oh, you're going to have a baby. Oh, you should have a baby. It's amazing. And she says, oh, it sort of equates it to being on QI and says, yeah, do you know what? Being on QI is amazing. I never knew I wanted to be on QI until I was on QI, until I saw Stephen Fry's little face. And, you know, that kind of all that bullshit that people give you about, oh, you really, oh, you know. It's that, to me, is more... I mean, people making a slip up and going, oh, you're going to have kids. You go, well, that is, like you say, it's just one of those things that they're probably just trying to be inclusive. Or, you know. But to then go on from
absolutely.
That point, to go, you should totally have kids. You know, you'll regret it if you don't. I mean, I have heard people say you regret it if you don't.
Thing. But you know what, fine, even at Comedy Club, when you say, does anyone have kids? And they go, yeah. Nobody goes, yes! Mm-hmm. In the way that they do, if you go, has anyone won the lottery? People go, yes! And they're so excited. Nobody is that. Once you have kids, I mean, I'm not saying it's a joyful thing and blah, 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 blah. But no one is that delighted after you have them because we're all really tired.
I know, and then you've just done it and you know you don't regret it. I mean, it's just one of those things, isn't it? You go, well, of course you don't regret it because you've done it. Mm. But then that's not to say that you can tell other people that they'll regret it if they don't, because of course the human experience is so different.
I remember holding Bella. And this is too much honesty, but, you know, it's that time of night. Holding Bella, thinking, this is the... And Bella was my firstborn. And thinking, this is the most selfish thing I've ever done in my life.
It is.
Because I didn't have a baby going, do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to have a baby and I'm going to give it the best life possible. I'm going to sit outside ballet classes and I'm going to be happy. When she falls over and skins her knee, I'm going to make that the best skinned knee that she's ever... I thought, I want a baby. Own baby. And that's pretty selfish.
Yeah, and I
that sounds... I know that's a bit deep and weird and horrible.
No, but I think a lot of people do then try and justify, once they've done it, to fend off any accusations of being selfish. They then try and make it into some kind of... Well, we do fetishise parenthood, I think, at the moment. And it is, like, from my mum and dad's point of view, because they were saying, you know, you just have babies and you got on with it. It's like everything that we do now, because we share it and everything's such a big deal.
And
it's like weddings.
We
were at a wedding the other day, and it was a lovely wedding, but my father-in-law was hilarious. He was like, oh, well, you know, when we got married, we took the afternoon off. You know, that classic older generation thing. We took the afternoon off and there was some like, a minor delay in getting the food. And my father-in-law was like, well, you know, at our wedding, they were handing out the knives and forks as we walked back down the aisle, you know. And everything, you know. And similarly, like my sister, who had a baby like 20 years ago, she was like, when she had a baby, you just had a baby. And now... It's just a, you know, it's a huge deal, and it's partly commercialisation. It's like, you know,
that reminds me of my baby shower for my last baby. My husband did a surprise baby shower. I'd never had a baby shower. My husband did a surprise baby shower, and Lucy Porter, the great Lucy Porter, who's not that brilliant at lying, took me out for lunch. We went out for lunch, and on the way back into my house, she said, "What about a baby shower? Have you ever thought of baby shower?" And on the way in, I went, "Oh God, not a baby shower! They're so grabby." Surprise! And I was just like, oh,
"Questions
shit.
You wish you'd never asked."
I think so funny. I love that thing that Charles Dickens said about, you know, each baby who's born is more precious than the one who was born just before, you know, so that every time there's like a birth, you know, it's more special somehow than the one that's just happened. Mm. And that's our journey, you know, that new life is formed and is given. And, you know, and so we kind of marvel at that. So I think there's an element of marvelling at, you know, a newborn. But I agree with you. You know, it's kind of this sort of lifestyle explosion, you know. But what's your lifestyle, you know? What car are you driving? What shot is it? Have you got a waitress car? You know, this whole thing that is defining us all the time. It's just...
We didn't have lifestyles.
Absolutely. Yes. You know, you want to have a life. And I really think that's just so important. And there's so much puff around it. And it's so dull. It's very dull.
What do you think's important?
We're living in a world where we're literally seeing... I mean, I was in the south of France in the summer. And I was
hashtag first world problem.
There was no problem with it. It was an absolute delight. But the point is that I was looking out over the Mediterranean and somebody came to visit on Monday and she was like, oh, wow, it's amazing. We went swimming in the sea. And I said, you know what I think's amazing about it? We're looking at this and in some part of the sea there are human beings bobbing in it. And there's that brilliant line drawing. It's like a cartoon. And there's this like the prow of a ship and there's a sort of naval commander looking over like this and this big sort of navy ship and he's looking down and there's this sort of like, you know, dinghy full of refugees all kind of falling out of the dinghy and looking up at him and he's got this bubble coming out of his mouth and he says, but where are you from? And this bubble comes out and they say, planet Earth. And I think that's what I'm talking about a life.
It's a very important point. And
it's not about, you know, where do you shop and what car are you driving? Are you going to have a baby? You know, are you going to have a baby shower? Yeah. It's like, God, can you live on this planet? Have we got enough for us to live and to survive as a human species? That's it. Sorry, am I bringing it down?
No, it's brilliant, but makes note never to go on holiday with Valerie.
There we go. Never heard Valerie on radio show.
No. Lovely radio, but when I'm on the beach, I'm thinking about my tan.
Isn't this a great sunset? Think of the refugees.
It's true, I'm so sorry. But
you should do, I tell you what though, you should advertise in The Guardian doing the Valerie Edmund holiday guilt tour.
Thompson Hardy by Valerie Edmund.
It's true.
But speaking of, and it is, you know,
you're right.
It is incredibly important. And I was going to draw our attention to Hillary Clinton, St. Hillary, about what she did a brave tweet. Which
a
is funny,
brave tweet.
You can be brave in your tweets.
In 40 characters?
But yeah, because actually she did, she stood up to the Chinese record on women's rights. And basically there was the Chinese were hosting a sort of UN, they were hosting a... Lucy, read the story before you start talking about it.
Should we have a record?
There we go. That'll give me time to catch up.
And she was hosting a year. Anyway, yes.
We'll have it because it's about time for a little song, I think. Something popped into my head. The lyrics to this, or just the title, popped into this into my head when you were talking about fertility. Voice of the Beehive, Don't Call Me Baby.
She's very slick.
The Lucy Porter Show on
FUBAR
Radio.
Hey, we're back and we have researched. Oh yeah. So the story that I was referring to about Hillary Clinton was that she said in a tweet on Sunday that Chinese President Xi Jinping was shameless for hosting a United Nations conference on women's rights that day.
Can you say the name of the Chinese president again three times?
I was really
quickly
hoping you'd ask me that.
Really quickly, no, but three times in a row, really quickly, go.
Xi Jinping, Xi Jinping, Xi Jinping.
Wendy,
that's probably
Wendy,
not
put
right.
Your phone
that's extraordinary.
Come on, that is, you are, okay.
Our Chinese listeners will be tweeting in now furiously about that. But Mr. Xi has come under fire for hosting the summit, as several women's rights activists were held early this year for planning a demonstration against sexual harassment on public transport. And rights groups say several female human rights activists remain in detention. Mrs. Clinton has made women's rights a signature part of her campaign. And it's... You know, and obviously the Chinese government have gone slightly ape about this. She has really lowered herself. Chinese people aren't angry at her, but we now despise her a little. Oh, it's nice to have that distinction between anger and despicableness.
How
would you do that?
Oh, you see my son's doing exams.
Despair.
Despicableness?
Yeah, let's just move on. Let's move on. But I, quite a fascinating woman, Hillary Clinton, and quite brave.
Have you read her biography?
And no, I have not.
It's really, really amazing because she has been involved in politics for a long, long time.
You're telling me.
And she's and I know people. Some people don't like her, and but I really, really respect her.
What do you think about the fact she stayed with her husband after he was involved with an alleged misdemeanor?
Well, here's the thing. I think the older you get, and depending on what your marriage is, I first of all, I think anyone's relationship is their business. So I would never get involved in what anyone's deal is. I mean, there's stuff that I couldn't forgive in my marriage that I'm sure other people could forgive in theirs. And that is fine because that is their marriage. And I'm sure I'd lose my shit over something minor and someone else would be, like, more than happy with whatever I lose my shit over. And that's their thing. But I also think that if, you know, if you're in a big part, like, if you look at Jay-Z and Beyonce or Victoria Beckham and David Beckham, they're a brand. They're a brand. And I don't
I know,
even
but it's
begin.
Always a bloke, isn't it? I mean, it's power, isn't it? A power corrupts.
Well, that's not yours. That's not your call to say that because you don't know. She might be fucking everyone else in the walks on the planet, and he might be devastated by it.
They might. We should.
You emphasize. Don't know.
They yes. might.
I've said might. No one knows what goes on in anyone else's marriage, and frankly, it's no one's business. I don't think. I know it's old-fashioned. But I don't think it's anyone's business.
Well, yeah.
And I think the public face... In France, if a politician's a good politician... What's that noise? If a politician is having, a relationship or whatever, that as long as they're still good at their job, that's fine.
Well, and then François Hollande is slightly...
François Hollande, yeah.
But it seems like that is changing slightly because we are, maybe as a species, we are becoming more prurient... Well, the news just travels.
I don't think it's none of our business. No, I don't think it's any of our business. I think if you're good at your job, people don't get elected and they don't do their job according to their moral code. In the same way that I think it's hilarious that our prime minister stuck his penis in a pig, allegedly. Whatever. I think he'd be more of a man if it was a live pig, but you know,
but,
there you go. There's
Wendy,
me with my demand.
Wendy,
but
we don't know if that's true.
That's what I said. That's what I said, allegedly, if whatever happened. My point is, if you're good at your job, just be good at your job and get on with it.
She has had an amazing... I will read her autobiography, and I'm ashamed that I haven't.
It's great. It's really great, because she was so interested in politics from an early age. And in her biography, she says, her autobiography, she says she's devastated by these allegations and claims. And also, what I find great about an autobiography is that you kind of go, yeah, well, that's what you're saying, but I guess... It's not entirely... Do you know what I mean? I'm sure that...
Well, writing an autobiography when you're running for high political office is a very different enterprise to writing a biography.
Exactly. Yeah.
When you're Lord Ashcroft and you are...
I'm not allowed in.
I'm going to burn my bridges with gay abandon. So, yeah, I mean, she's obviously... Yeah, she's got an image and a brand herself to protect. But she... I wanted to talk, actually, about your amazing woman... that you have chosen. We get our guests to nominate an amazing woman that they would like to talk about, someone inspirational. And talking about Hillary Clinton, let's talk about another First Lady.
Eleanor Roosevelt. I think she's an amazing... she was an amazing, amazing woman. She was the first. I mean, it sounds minor.
Tell me about Eleanor Roosevelt from start to finish, please.
You know about it. I kind of do,
and I know lots of. I mean, there are lots of incredible quotations and sort of inspirational ideas that I have heard attributed to her.
Well, so. Basically, she was obviously one of the most famous first ladies. She was a politician, a diplomat, an activist. She was the longest serving first lady of the United States. She was really active in making America join... I would like to say she made America join the United Nations, but that's probably because I love her. Maybe she wasn't as active, but she was one of the... She was the most active person. She was the first lady to give a press conference on her own. She was really active in politics. She discovered that her husband was having an affair, and it wasn't one of those. And I found it really interesting in the parallels between her and Hillary Clinton. Is she discovered her husband was having an affair with his secretary, and had gone, do you know what the path I'm on? I'll carry on doing what I'm doing, and I'm not happy about it, but. You know, and then, of course, as soon as that happened, in the same way, I feel like whenever any man does something wrong, they find something that the woman's done wrong. So automatically, the minute that comes out, she's a lesbian and she's had affairs with this person, she's had affairs with that person. So I kind of, you read about Eleanor Roosevelt and she's amazing. She was an amazing woman. She, one of my favourite quotes, because her, she was related to, she married Franklin Roosevelt, mm-hmm. but she was related to Teddy Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. And Teddy Roosevelt said, she married her fifth cousin. And Teddy Roosevelt said, well, you know, it's great to keep the name in the family. Which I thought was quite funny. But yes. She was a United States delegate to the United Nations. She was the chairman of the United Nations Commission on Human Rights. She was big on human rights at a time when it wasn't cool to be big on human rights. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She fought. I just, you know, and I remember, like, I was speaking to the kids about this and, like, my daughter said something quite interesting, which I was kind of like, we were talking about she went to an assembly on human rights. She said, it's so difficult for me, Mummy, because they're talking to us about human rights, but you know, and I want to help, but what am I going to do? I'm 13 years old. And I thought it's quite interesting because so often quite a lot of the stuff that Eleanor Roosevelt says is, what am I going to do? I'm a white middle class privileged woman, and but she fought, and I just find her very inspirational. And you know, as soon as you know Frank, her husband got polio, and she had a difficult time with her mother-in-law, and she fought through that. And you know, she was just, and there's so many inspirational quotes about Eleanor Roosevelt that you could just, you know, reel off. But I just think she's a great woman.
And it is, I think, really fascinating what women did before they were openly allowed to aspire to political office or to crave power and influence. The way that they had to be subtle, you know, it's such an art.
I love the way you said crave power, because a man can just seek power, but a woman has to crave it.
I crave it, but I'm a woman. I crave it. I'm Lady Macbeth. It's not natural for me to want power. I crave it.
Yes, it's true. I've absorbed the language of the patriarchy.
Sorry, you're absolutely right.
But yes, but
she was also given so much shit for being so outspoken. She was the one that, like, the most controversial first lady because. She didn't just fit into that remit. Mm. And I find that extraordinary.
I know. Well, I mean, Hillary, similarly, I mean, was one of the most unpopular first ladies of all time. And, I mean, I remember loving her at the time because there was some controversy about the fact that she didn't bake. Yeah. There was Laura Bush was a baker and Hillary wasn't.
And Valerie said something amazing about Hillary Clinton's advice to any future first ladies. What's the key thing?
Valerie's going to leave us hanging now. Come on. Come on.
She said, apparently, she said the most important thing that you... She was giving some kind of lecture to sort of Harvard or Princeton, kind of wonderful, gifted women. And she said, the thing that you'll be remembered for, get it right, is your hair. So get your hair right, because you'll be kind of vilified if it's wrong. You'll be, you know, it's kind of... defining thing about you as you're here, which sounds like an anti-feminist thing to say, but I think it's not. And actually, one, because she said it, and two, because, you know, it's kind of how, you know, if you're in public life, and I think it comes back to that thing of Wendy, you know, about the idea that, you know, that it doesn't matter what happens in someone's private life. I think that's true, but we are, when people are in public office, we need to know that they are deserving of our vote, of our kind of energy, if you like.
So do you think their morals come into...
Yes, I think it's important. I think
totally.
Because
I don't give a fuck if they're morally...
No, I do, because I think, who are you?
I want them to be good at their job.
No, but I want them... But to be good at their job, they have to... Their job is... what they have chosen to do, and if that's to serve the public and the public's interests, then who are they to do so? So that's my question.
I'm kind of somewhere between the two of you in that I think I agree that it shouldn't matter, but I think it does. But that is largely, I think, because and I agree with the Hillary Clinton hair advice as well, because it's you're dealing with the world the way it is, not the way that you wish it could be. And unfortunately, you know, it's the compromise and the decision that we all have to make all the time, isn't it? Of kind of going, how much of the shit that people expect me to do, do I do? And just get on with that because it allows me to do more important things. So I will sort out my hair because I know otherwise that'll be a massive thing and it will detract from the message I'm actually trying to get out.
Ooh. I always thought that when Gordon Brown, you know, went down, when he left 10 Downing Street with his children, that his wonderful wife, Sarah Brown, and his beautiful boys, and he walked down Downing Street, and that was then they were leaving after that dreadful moment when Nick Clegg made a call, and, you know, whatever your politics are, in my opinion, to the wrong person. But I always think with Gordon Brown, you know, that thing, I always wanted to write something for him, this idea that he stood up, and he should have stood up and said, you know, listen, I'm not the photogenic guy. You're not going to get a photo shot, you know, of me that you can put on Twitter and Facebook. And I'm not your social media go-to guy. I don't have the you know, the line and little kind of, you know, bite-sized comments and all the rest of it. But I'm a politician and I'm here to serve the interests of this country. And
so what do you think of Jeremy Corbyn then?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm kind of learning about him, and from what I've learned so far, I like what he's saying. I like what he's talking about the values of people.
But Ed Miliband did try to sort of explicitly do that and say, but unfortunately, he did it in a slightly American sounding speech, and it
but
was.
But he tried
just
to do that kind of which makes me think.
Yeah, there was something.
So,
a bit
do you
insincere.
Agree with Matt this week? Matt Damon said. Sorry, and going on from what happens in your private life to what happens in your public and in your work life.
And he said, "There's Matt nothing Damon interesting
said,
no, about
Matt
me."
Matt Damon said that actors should be able to play gay or straight, so that they shouldn't
Nobody
come
should
out.
Know. That's right.
Yeah. So, how do you feel about that then?
Yeah, I agree with him about that. I think
do
that's
you?
A different thing. Yes,
so that actors should not come out if they're gay.
Yeah, I think that it's very hard because I think actors are playing a role and they're entitled to their private life. But I think somebody in public office is saying to people, "This is what I believe." Policy should be, this is how I feel we should be living our lives, and I think you should vote for me for that. And in fact, they're not living their life like that. So there's an element of hypocrisy there that I don't enjoy. It could be, Wendy, you could be right that it's acceptable that it's part in his private life, and I'm a great believer in that. I absolutely think it's horrible that actors are doorstopped by people and photographs are taken. And I spent a fantastic evening one night with Sienna Miller, who, you know,
what's
was talking
she like?
About.
Do we love her? Is she a girl's girl or do we not like her?
Absolutely. Gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous,
thin and gorgeous and nice,
and no, but also no, thin and gorgeous and vilified by the press for many years over her private life, which was to have an affair with another actor and then to have an affair with a married man in America, etc., etc. She was ruined, and yet, and what I love is the fact she's having this wonderful career now because she's a very talented girl. But she fought the press. She went to, you know, the press commission, and she said they don't have a right to tap my phone. They don't have this. And she was one of the first people I remember saying to me. She said, "Nobody knows this about me, but I have this kind of restrictive thing. They cannot take photographs of me."
But
she
then
said
having
she used
said that,
to be
I
going
remember,
home.
I remember
she lived down a little dark street, you know, in town. She used to go home, take her keys out, and turn, and there would be. Like 11 men, horrible men with photo lenses, like cramming her, and she would go in and her heart would be racing and she'd slam her door shut.
Scary.
How absolutely.
That's
but why?
Terrifying.
Because of her talent or because sexually she was sleeping with maybe Daniel Craig, maybe Jude Law. So wrong. You know, it's vilification.
But I remember
of women.
Standing outside the Groucho Club having, like, in the olden days, having a cigarette with her and her shouting at the press, and you can't take photographs of me, can you, because of the restriction, and it was almost like taunting, and I was thinking, you've won your argument, why are you doing, I couldn't understand, maybe it was some kind of vilification for her, but I remember kind of going, why are you, for someone who's fought the press and won, why are you now yelling at them that they can't take photographs of you outside the Groucho Club where they're all stood? What's that?
But I think that I mean, it's interesting. You're talking about Eleanor Roosevelt. I think all of us want to be known by what we're capable of, what we're able to do, not, you know, what man we've slept with. And the interest of the press is, you know, in many occasions, not always, of course, but is, you know, here's a woman. What is her value? Who wants to sleep with her? Let's start from there rather than let's talk about what she's achieved, which comes back to sport, which is it's this kind of incredible kind of thing. This is what she beat this record. Liz McCogan, you know, Paula Radcliffe, you know, Serena Williams, these extraordinary athletes, Jessica Innes, you know.
Yeah. I know, and actually, you, with sport, you can put yourself almost beyond criticism
approach.
By doing that. But with acting, it is because it's subjective. Comedy is the same. Music, arguably, is the same. You know, I mean, I think, you know, musical talent like Adele or, you know, people will go, okay, yeah, fair enough, we'll let her off. But you're right. I mean, I think acting, though, is a sort of special case as well, isn't it? Because the whole Matt Damon thing, which was, if you're a gay actor and you come out, and I think he cited the case of Rupert Everett, didn't he? And he said that, you know, Rupert Everett, basically beautiful what he was trying to say was Rupert Everett, beautiful man, and coming out clearly damaged
his
chances.
Killed his career, yeah.
And, but what I found interesting about that is that, that the really public, is that, because I think what it is it's sensitivity on the part of the studio saying no one's going to buy you as a romantic lead in a heterosexual film now. Yeah. But I wonder if that is actually the case and whether that's ever been tested.
But I think it's really interesting that, sorry, I'm pointing, that the in the golden age of Hollywood, they protected their stars so much that nobody really knew about them. And now we want more access to our stars. So we want to know more about them. So you get these kind of, this is him on a beach without anybody noticing. And it's clear, and once you've spotted it, it's clearly staged secret photographs on a beach.
But again, then, to be fair, that's probably someone going, I'll give you this much access in order to protect some privacy. It's now the negotiation you have to make if you want to be an actor is not, you know, a lot of it's not about your work or your craft. It's about what, how
the
much
PR
access
company,
you
and also we, like, I know PR companies who have traded off one star and
I'm getting on legal terms here.
Yeah, but I know
really,
PR
let's
companies,
not go there because
no,
we really
I,
will.
I can do it. I know PR companies who have said that don't publish a story about this star, but I can tell you that this other star is hiding on in this hotel, and if you put this hotel on the front page of AN other newspaper.
I think there's a real problem with the idea that actors, and especially, it's interesting you're talking about Matt Damon, and we've referenced Cate Blanchett tonight, and to me she's kind of beyond any kind of, you know, you wouldn't tag her with something that was sexual. And what I think is so wonderful about what's happening to Sienna Miller's career is that she's dignifying her talent right now. Mm-hmm. And boy oh boy, that's wonderful, because she's moved away from her romantic life, which, as Wendy said, is totally private, and she's now dignifying herself.
Fascinating, but totally, you know, private.
But none of her business, as Wendy said,
yes,
and she's absolutely
agree.
Right with that. And I think, you know, this idea that actresses equals somebody who's sexually available in some level, I think is absolute.
And
I remember reading,
I
just want to finish one thing on this, is I was reading something and it was in the back of a newspaper, it might be in the Standard, it might be in the Ham and High or something local like that, and it said ex-actress offering massage and such, call this number. And I called the number and this lady answered, and she was, you know, of Eastern European origin, and she was like, yes, can I help you? And I said, yeah. I said, I just wondered why in your ad you've mentioned that you're an ex-actress that's offering massage. And she said, oh, you know, I do not write the ad, I don't. And I said, you know, I totally understand that. I said, but whoever has written it for you, I'm an actress. And I said, and being an actress and offering massage is not in any way related. I said, I wonder if you could dignify my profession and remove it, or ask the person who wrote it. And I know we're into a dark underworld of, you know, human life and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But the idea that there's an association of ex-actress offers massage, you know, that if you're, you know, if you're offering massage, i.e. in an element of sexual favours, an actress will always be there to help you through.
You
know,
might as well offer an actress as
actually,
a cook.
No, do you know what? I went to drama school, you know, I stood in a room and I learned, you know, Shakespeare sonnets, and I love language and I love being in a room, and when someone says action, I have to create the truth of that moment. That is my craft, that is my job. If I don't do my job, I don't, you know, I don't get work. And, you know, don't equate it with something that's to do with sexuality. And that's what really worries me about how the world is going and how women are being portrayed.
Yes. I had a really interesting thing that my husband was at, we were at a wrap party for my husband's job the other week there. And my husband came in, he's an actor, and they all said, I'll do this quickly because I know we're running out of time. He said, people coming in, people said to my husband, oh, you're great an actor, you're great this, and you're great this. And the director came in, they were like, oh, I love your show, it's great. And I can't say what show this is, but the director of photography walked in, and three guys went, oh, I like your dress. And I went, fucking batshit mental. And my husband and I told Valerie about this, and Valerie was like, that wasn't your gig to go mental about it. But I was just so angry that all the boys got complimented on
their ability.
The ability.
And she got complimented on her how she looks.
Dress. Yeah. And you were really cool. Valerie, being my friend, was like, well, maybe she's been seen in jeans and they were trying to be nice to her.
And they think that's what
and
you want
to
hear.
And you were being rational and I was being like, oh, God, oh, that's like shit.
I'm pretty sure in future they will know that is not what is the appropriate, the weight and touch has been applied there. I also think the ex-actress thing for offering sexual services is a bit, if you're going to do, I mean, because what use is an ex-actress, really? It's ex-chiropodist. Mm. That's what you want. Mm. Something like that, because then they go, I'll get a wank off and I'll get my feet seen to.
Well, there's a great thing in Germany where they're bringing in prostitutes to old people's homes because they reckon they're the great people to have, because they're really good at people putting people at their ease. They're good at listening, and they've got zero fear of bodily fluids. So they're putting and old people and there's no sexual thing there, because you know prostitutes don't want to be doing sexual favors. They want to make people feel comfortable and earn a living.
Yeah,
and that makes them perfect for old people's homes.
Sex workers, not prostitutes. That's what I'm saying. she says trying to win the right on Olympics in the studio tonight. Right, should we have another little record? Because we are galloping.
It will be a little record, because then when we come back we'll have just time to say goodbye. So I think.
We can just stay in the studio.
Yeah, we don't have to go anywhere.
But, occupy.
let's play this.
The Lucy Porter Show on FUBAR Radio.
There's that sting for the final time. Well, it's flown. It's bloody flown by with my two wonderful companionesses.
Favourite companions.
My favourite people. Shall we do a roundup of what we're all up to? I'm not really doing much. Has the school run, actually, Valerie, have you done that or are you doing that?
Yeah, I did it on, when did I do it? The other night, Saturday night, at the Canal Cafe Theatre, because the lovely actress who was supposed to be doing it didn't feel very well, and they called me and asked me if I would come in and do it. So I went on stage with a script in my hand.
Oh, great. So the show went on.
Show went on. I know, it's the old showbiz. The show must go on. But it's very funny. And I went along. They were doing the read-through. They were doing a sort of run-through. And I arrived at the theatre at 6. And I was laughing my socks off. And I sat backstage. I had two little bits to do in it. And it's very funny. And I'm sure it will continue to grow, that show. It's on there for a couple of gigs in the next couple of weeks. And then it finishes. And I'm sure it will go on and have wings, because it deserves to. The people who've devised it are very, very clever, very funny.
Cool. We'll look out for that. And tell us what else we can see you in, please.
What else can you see me in that I'm thinking about? I can't think of anything right now.
We'll put it on we'll put it out on the on the tweets and that. I know, because I've got to think about what I'm doing next. I've got no idea. People always say, "Oh, you know, what you're up to." No
going
idea.
Going to the pub,
really.
Aren't we?
We're going to the pub. Yep. We're going to the pub. Thank you very much for listening, everybody, and thank you so much to Valerie Edmund and Wendy Mason.
Oh, a pleasure. Lucy, thank you so much.
I'm doing a gig next week.
Oh, hello. Sorry. Oh, so somebody's busy. All right, then here we go. Wendy would like to tell us about stellar career.
I'm gigging.
Here we go.
I am. First of all, I'm going to see my friend Lou Sanders. We should all go and see Lou Sanders.
Oh, yes,
she
please.
She is hilarious. Okay, we're going to be quick. Lou Sanders at Soho Theatre on the 9th of October. I'm in Bishop Auckland. On the 16th of October, I'm going to be hilarious and rude. Thank you.
Hey, come along in Bishop Auckland. Right, that's us done. See you next week. And lots of love. I never know how to end a show. Hooray for ladies! Bye!